This is the Charlottesville Podcasting Network at cvillepodcast.com. Lectures, radio shows, and more are available on demand at cvillepodcast.com. Now available through email. Sign up in our left-hand margin. I'm Dan Daniels. Adam Clymer served as the New York Times national political correspondent, polling editor, political editor, weekend senior editor, chief congressional correspondent, Washington editor, and Washington correspondent before retiring in 2003. He also wrote op-ed articles, obituaries, and an outdoors column during his tenure there. Clymer has also worked for the Virginian Pilot, the New York Daily News, and the Baltimore Sun. Clymer's presentation is entitled The Panama Canal Treaties and the Rise of the Right. He spoke at a Miller Center forum on September 19th, 2008.
Good morning and welcome to the Miller Center Forum. When I started graduate school here a little while ago at the age of 54, the president of the university said that his job was to challenge the students' orthodoxies every day. And he did that. And Adam Clymer has been doing that with the American public for many years. Many commentators, many historians trace the contemporary political fault lines, the bright line division between the red and the blue, to the Vietnam War or the Reagan-Cold War legacy or tax cut policy or the culture wars over choice or the sectarian battles over the proper place of religion in our public life. Adam Clymer now invites us to consider the role that the battle over the Panama Canal treaties played in defining modern conservatism. Adam Clymer's latest book, Drawing the Line at the Big Ditch, The Panama Canal Treaties and the Rise of the Right, does just that. Clymer was educated at Harvard, the University of Cape Town, and Georgetown, and this is actually his second book that takes a look at the Reagan legacy. And in 1999, he wrote the definitive study of the long-serving senator from Massachusetts, Edward M. Kennedy, A Biography, a book I might say that the scholars here in our building who are working on the oral history project of Senator Kennedy consult regularly. Adam Clymer cut his journalistic teeth at the Virginian Pilot in Norfolk, and then ended his long career in journalism with a 26-year stint at the New York Times, serving as the chief Washington correspondent from 1999 to 2000. He received some unsought fame in 2000 when President Bush described him in scatological terms, and Vice President Cheney said into an open mic that he agreed that Adam Clymer was big time. Please welcome Adam Clymer. And I would warn you that the mic is always on.
Okay. Well, the incident that George recalled, I always reflected on that the way the character of Mark Twain's did. He was tarred, feathered, and ridden out of town on the rail, and he observed if it weren't for the honor of it, he'd have sooner walked. This occasion, I suspect, even if there's some sharp questioning, will be somewhat more civil. The university generally is. This is a book I've worked on for a few years. The University of Kansas Press put it out, and I'm going to give you basically a summary of the argument, and I really look forward to questions of things I haven't either thought of at all or hadn't thought to put in. The message is that conservatives came to power in the United States for a whole variety of reasons, because of the depth of their ideas, because of the new activity of Christian politicians, because in 1980 of the contrast between a sunny, optimistic view of Reagan, speaking of the country as the shining city on the hill, and a Jimmy Carter who really seemed adrift in malaise and problems of one sort or another. But the occasion for this transformation, I argue, was really a generous decision by the four presidents who preceded Reagan to give up the Panama Canal in order to keep it open. I'll get into the detail of the argument back and forth a little later, but the canal had a meaning in American history. It was something everybody read about in school books. Probably there are a few of us here who did. I know I did. It was an enormous triumph. It was the beginning of what Time magazine later called the American century. The United States triumphed over jungle and disease to build the greatest engineering work in the history of the world. And it was an achievement that, as Donald Rumsfeld might put it, old Europe had failed at. The French had tried to build one and it hadn't worked. A 1928 school book text I found summed it up this way: American pluck and luck conquered all. The grand dream was realized. In 1913, the waters of the Atlantic and the Pacific were joined. Well, it was not only a national monument, but the time of this, the mid and late 70s, was after the United States had been defeated and had finally figured out it had been defeated by a small country a long way away, Vietnam. And so the idea of being pushed around by another small country, particularly one that the United States had sired or at least midwifed, was also very galling to Americans. There was a logical argument for doing it, but there were intense emotional arguments against. And what did the issue do? Well, first of all, it revived a conservative movement that had grown sullen over the years of Nixon and Ford, who hadn't been as conservative as they hoped. To a lot of people, they seemed conservative, but not to the purists. It kept perhaps the most important single example, excuse me, I got a scratchy throat, was that it kept Reagan alive in 1976. It set him up to be the front runner for the Republican nomination of 1980. And without the issue, I argue, he probably wouldn't have made it in 1980. It also won enough Senate seats so that in 1981, when Reagan became president, there was a Republican majority, a friendly majority leader who knew his way around Washington more than the Reagan people did, and friendly committee chairman. And this overlooked moment in American political history also provided vitality, money, and people for the conservative movement. Now, to come back to these things in some detail, March of 1976, Ronald Reagan was running for president against an incumbent of his own party, and he wasn't doing very well. He'd lost the first five primaries. And Ford seemed about to run the table on him. Not only had Reagan lost in New Hampshire, Massachusetts, Florida, Illinois, and somewhere else, I forget, his campaign manager, John Sears, was negotiating with the Ford campaign about a Reagan withdrawal. Even more important, Nancy Reagan thought he was being humiliated and was trying to talk him into dropping out. And furthermore, the campaign was broke. It was really out of money. Indeed, when Reagan was planning to come to North Carolina to campaign in that primary, his plane had to wait on the tarmac in Los Angeles for about an hour while they checked and United Airlines checked to make sure that the check for the rental would clear. But when he got there, got to North Carolina, he hit very hard on the canal issue. Some of you may recall the slogan, "We bought it, we built it, it's ours, and we're going to keep it," sometimes modified by saying, "And we're going to tell that tin horn dictator Torrijos we're going to keep it," various things like that. Reagan was a great stump speaker when he got aroused, and he was aroused over the canal, which he genuinely believed shouldn't be given up because it would lead other countries to think they could take advantage of the United States. They used a half-an-hour television program, which was sort of a throwback. By, you know, the earliest television commercials in the 40s and early 50s had a candidate speak into a camera for 15 minutes or half an hour, much as radio commercials had done before. By the 70s, there were campaign spots more similar to the things we see today. And people in Reagan's campaign hadn't wanted him to make a speech, as he'd done rather effectively as governor of California to the people of California, because they said it would remind people he was an actor. Well, he was really very good looking into a camera and speaking, very effective. And they used a speech on foreign policy that he had actually made during the Florida primary when a station offered him a half an hour of time. They edited it a little. They took the palm trees out. They put in an address to send money to. And the most memorable part of the speech focused on the canal and the idea that the United States was being blackmailed into giving up something that was vital to its security. Well, Reagan, to his surprise, and for that matter to the surprise of such conservative commentators as Bill Buckley and James Jackson Kilpatrick, won. He won in North Carolina. He then used the issue, won all the delegates in Texas, all the delegates in Alabama and Georgia, and won a lot of primaries. He came very close to winning the nomination. He did have a disadvantage, and that is he was running against an incumbent president. As he sometimes bitterly complained, when Ford would campaign, he'd announce various local grants. Reagan used to say, "The band never knew whether to play Hail to the Chief or Santa Claus is Coming to Town." Well, Ford, the most dramatic advantage Ford had was as President of the United States in the bicentennial year, he commanded the USS Forrestal, a carrier in New York Harbor, where he viewed the parade of tall ships. Sitting with him on the flight deck were a lot of uncommitted delegates, and most of them ended up voting for Ford. But Reagan came close. There was a little doubt at the Kansas City Convention. There was no doubt after he spoke at the convention, once Ford had been nominated and accepted, that the hearts of the Republican Party were with Reagan. And it set him up for 1980. Now, what if Reagan had not seized on that issue and had been beaten as badly as it seemed in mid-March of 1976 that he was going to be? Well, the what-ifs of history are not answerable. I put this question to a lot of people, aides and friends of his. Some of them thought he'd have run again. Some of them thought he wouldn't. I figured, well, here's somebody who ought to know, and I got in touch with Nancy Reagan, and she said it was a very interesting question, but it had never come up. As she said, Ronnie never had a way of looking back, and that's true. This was something that would show later in the Panama Canal story. My own sense is that he would not have run again, that her pressure on him not to, and the fact that people would be saying that would be looking for new faces would have kept him from running. But even if I'm wrong and he had run, he wouldn't have come into 1980 as the obvious front runner for the nomination. There would have been a lot of talk in the party and elsewhere, just as there had been in 1964, that his overwhelming loss, like Goldwater's before him, showed that someone that conservative couldn't win. I don't mean that we wouldn't have had a conservative movement or a conservative presidency since then, but they'd have had to wait longer than 1980. Now, it's interesting that Reagan, despite the effort he made in the campaign, never led the anti-treaty fight. He made some speeches. He appeared here and there. He even did one national television address because CBS offered him time. And one of the things I discovered in reading this, I had always been puzzled about that reluctance of his. Well, in August of 1977, the treaties had been negotiated in Panama. And President Carter sent the ambassadors who negotiated it, Saul Linowitz and Ellsworth Bunker, to see Reagan in hopes of getting him to support the treaties or take no position. And they made the case very firmly that this treaty assured that the United States could use the canal, and that if the treaty were rejected, the chances were that the canal would be sabotaged. I mean, it's sitting there in the middle of a jungle. A reasonably competent three-man mortar team could have done a lot of damage before anyone could have gotten to them. Or just sink one ship in a lock, and even if you could get it out, other shippers would begin to worry about whether this was a good route to use. Well, Reagan wasn't persuaded, but when they left, he turned to Nancy and to Pete Hannaford, the aide who told me the story, and said, what if they're right? And they judged from that while he would maintain his formal opposition, he wasn't going to be front and center and the most obvious opponent of the treaties. Bill Buckley, editor of National Review and a good friend of Reagan's, once wrote, I think ironically that Reagan would not have been nominated if he had favored the treaty, and that he wouldn't have been elected if they hadn't passed. He'd have lost the conservatives if he had backed the treaty and lost the election if we'd subsequently faced in Panama insurrection, as in my opinion we would have. Buckley and Reagan had a good laugh later over that. Buckley drove a few months later up to visit Reagan for dinner at his house in Beverly Hills, and Reagan had erected a bunch of signs, like Burma Shave signs, that you would see as you drove up the driveway. First said, we built it. And the second said, we bought it. And the third said, it's ours and we're going to keep it, meaning the house. Now, the issue moved forward. When Carter became president, it hadn't figured in the Democratic primary contest at all. When Carter became president, he was a quick study. He saw the arguments that his predecessors had made about the threat to the canal if the Panamanians remained hostile. And he told me, he added one reason to those that had led both Johnson, Nixon, and Ford to decide to negotiate a treaty that would return the canal. He said, I wanted to treat Panama fairly. I had studied the issue fairly thoroughly, and I was convinced that it was an unfair original agreement that was foisted upon the Panamanian people against their will. There was no doubt that I was determined to go through with the Panama Canal because I thought I could succeed, and I did not anticipate the antipathy and the concerted effort that was aroused around the country against it. I underestimated the opposition by a lot. Now, the opponents of the canal treaties, I think there's no question that they genuinely believe that it was still a vital military installation, that turning it over to Panama would threaten the United States' ability to use it, and that indeed the instability of Panama and Omar Torrijos' friendship with Fidel Castro suggested that the communists might somehow seize it or take it over. But they had another reason. They saw a dynamite political issue, not merely in terms of their ability to use it against Carter or Democrats, but the idea of creating a new party had been abandoned, but the Republican Party was in conservative sights. Paul Laxalt, Reagan's closest friend in Washington and in the Senate, said conservatives will control the party as a result of the Panama Canal, adding, it's a natural issue to galvanize our people for fundraising and to gear up the troops. It's manna from heaven. Howard Phillips, the head of the conservative caucus, said, I can't think of any other issue that better unites grassroots conservatives than the canal. And Gary Jarman, the legislative director of the American Conservative Union, said, Conservatives see this as a great opportunity to take control of the Republican Party. We should control it, because we're the dominant element of the party, and without us, it would die. And he explained that they had a hit list of Republican senators they were going to go after. There's one other remarkable figure in the canal fight in the Senate, and that's Howard Baker of Tennessee. He was Dirksen's son-in-law, a fellow who, by most lights, voted pretty conservatively, but he wasn't an ideologue, and he was the minority leader. When Carter called him to tell him the treaties had been settled, Baker said his reaction was, "Why me and why now?" Baker was thinking of running for president in 1980 himself, and he'd hired a fellow named Jim Cannon, who was his, who had been an aide to Ford and to Vice President Rockefeller, to help prepare the way. And Cannon told him, gave him a piece of political advice that said, "If you support the treaty, the Republican Party will never nominate you for president." And Baker's reaction was, "Well, so be it." He thought he could work out some modifications to the treaty that would make it, in his view, acceptable, and he thought it was his job as a senator and as a party leader to do it. Now, this is something I've never seen before. Howard Baker was a plausible, or since, Howard Baker was a plausible presidential candidate. Now, these days, senators see a presidential candidate every day when they shave, or these days put on lipstick. But he was also plausible to the press and to the Carter White House, which feared him more than they feared Ronald Reagan. As I say, he made a decision that, of a sort that I haven't encountered in four decades of covering Congress. You may recall that the debate went on for a long time, 10 weeks in the Senate after 3 or 4 months of committee hearings and other extravaganzas. It was important not really for the debate. There were some pretty good oratory, but it all could have been done in a week or two. It wasn't important for the amendments that were offered, most of them designed to get the enable a senator to say, "I approve the treaty, now I can vote for it." They were generally not amendments to the treaty itself, but understandings or other boilerplate. Certainly it wasn't important for the persuasion of from the logic of the debate. It was a livelier debate than most because since it was the first broadcast of the Senate, people decided that they needed to have someone from the other side, needed to have someone ready to answer the other side. If you watch a Senate debate on C-SPAN these days, what you see is our serial monologues. You know, somebody finishes a speech and then suggests the absence of a quorum while they look around to see if anybody else wants to come in and talk for a while. Now, the debate was heard not only throughout the United States, but in simultaneous translation in Latin America. Torrijos would get infuriated by the anti-Panamanian comments. A lot of people sort of compared them to jungle monkeys and various other unsavory terms. And he would take a radio and throw it and smash it against the wall. And then after a while, he decided he needed to listen some more, so he'd call his aides and said, "Get me another radio." Eventually, they got a case of them in a closet. They'd just bring them out. But the debate was really important for the occasion it gave the new right to rally the public against the treaties. One of the lasting benefits we've had are infomercials. Now, I don't know if you ever wake up at 2:30 in the morning and don't have anything to read and switch on the television set to see if there's anything, you can find a half an hour explaining that, you know, for just a little money you can get flat abs in 30 days or grow some more hair or whatever. Well, that was really invented in the Panama Canal debate. The product they were selling, the American Conservative Union, through a half-hour program that was shown a couple of hundred times around the country, was opposition to the canal treaties, and they had various speakers on the program. And they said, "If you just send $10 to help us spread the message, we can stop the treaty." And the message was really both there and in direct mail. It was a very important and simple message, much simpler than the message for the people who were trying to get support for the treaties. It was, tell your senator that if he doesn't vote no, you'll vote no on him the next time he comes up for election. Richard Viguerie, the postmaster general of the new right, said, we've raised money and rallied our troops for the battle ahead. The first of those battles where it really came through was in New Hampshire. New Hampshire had Senator Tom McIntyre. He was an Irish Catholic Democrat, but in personality he'd have been a New England WASP. He was taciturn, he didn't like to spend money, he wasn't a showman by any standards. And he supported the treaties, knowing there would be a lot of intense opposition. Now, New Hampshire had some of the strangest politics in the country at that time. It had a loony governor named Meldrum Thompson, who, among other things, lowered the flag on Good Friday and wanted to arm the National Guard with tactical nuclear weapons. That's when he wasn't traveling in South Africa praising apartheid or going to Taiwan and promising United States military support against the communists. It also had the Manchester Union leader. Probably, though there was some competition in Indianapolis and Phoenix, the worst newspaper in the United States at the time. It was heavily biased, called people names all the time. Dopey Dwight for Eisenhower was one of the kinder ones. And it had he also confronted a candidate of surprisingly little background but enormous energy. Gordon Humphrey was a co-pilot for Allegheny Airlines. He'd once been a Democrat. He'd voted for Hubert Humphrey in '68. He was on the Alexandria, Virginia Democratic Town Committee. But when he moved up to New England, he chose to live in New Hampshire because there were less taxes and it didn't seem as liberal as Massachusetts. And he got involved in the conservative caucus. A lot of the new right organizations are really letterhead organizations without members. Staff members, money-raising devices, but not people. The Conservative Caucus did have chapters in just about every congressional district in the country. And Humphrey had worked part-time for them, really volunteered on his days off from flying. And he didn't think anyone else was going to run against McIntyre and make a big issue out of the canal, so he decided he would. And he campaigned tirelessly. He took off only one day from the day he announced his candidacy in March until Election Day, and he took that day off to get married, but no time off for a honeymoon. McIntyre knew trouble was coming. He told his wife on the day of the first treaty vote, Myrtle, come on and watch me lose my seat. Well, there were four other seats, and he was right, he lost by 5,800 votes. There were four other Senate seats, and I discuss them in the book in some detail, where if the canal issue had never come up, I argue, or if the Democrat in question had voted against the treaties, the result would have been different. It wasn't always the single most important reason, but it was critical in, in Iowa for Dick Clark in 78, in North Carolina for Robert Morgan in 1980, in Idaho for Frank Church in 1980, and in Georgia for Herman Talmadge in 1980. Well, those five seats produced a majority for the Republicans in the Senate, the first they had since 1955. Ironically, it made the majority leader Howard Baker, who'd given up his presidential chances, really, by supporting the treaties. What difference did it make? Well, it sometimes seems that the word leader is ill-used to describe the United States Senate. But there is one power that the majority leader has, and that is scheduling, what comes up and when and what doesn't come up. And that was Baker's sense of timing was very valuable to the Reagan administration. Jim Baker Reagan's chief of staff told me that that help in the Senate was essential for getting their tax and spending cuts through in the first couple of years. And Reagan understood that. Dick Werthlin, his pollster, told him in 1982 that they were going to lose a lot of seats in the House, but there was an 80% chance they'd still maintain control of the Senate. It would be disastrous if we don't, Reagan wrote in his diary. Well, the Reagan presidency, as I've argued, wouldn't have happened without the canal issue. That's one legacy of the debate. There are others, and beyond the infomercial. Their single-issue ads began developing in that. There were a lot of ads around the canal against various people, various candidates. Early attacks, before somebody has even got an opponent, are now a feature of the television landscape. Well, the National Conservative Political Action Committee, or NCPAC, through an outfit it called the Anyone But Church Committee, was running ads against Frank Church long before anyone declared in opposition, and they were hammering him on the canal. And then independent spending, nothing like the millions that MoveOn.org or Swift Vote Veterans for Truth spent the last time out. But that also began over the canal. The American Conservative Union spent $16,000 on ads, mostly on the radio and newspapers, telling people to support Reagan because of the canal issue. There are other issues, things that have changed. I'm sorry. There are other things that have changed, and there, I think the country is no doubt more conservative now than it was in the 70s. But it's also more divided. Some of that division started showing very quickly. Howard Baker told a bunch of reporters a few months after the canal treaties were adopted that while the idea that politics stops at the water's edge had been all right and appropriate in Arthur Vandenberg's time, it was by now outdated. So, in some ways, while the canal itself no longer divides Panama, its heritage has helped divide the United States. Anyhow, that's my thesis. So, does anyone have any questions?
I will move to the back of the room and invite those with questions to join me back there. Adam, if I may sort of prime the pump, how in the world did you get interested in this topic?
Well, I first got interested in the topic of the Panama Canal the way a lot of people did. I read about it as a school kid. There was a book called Richard Halliburton's Book of Marvels. A showman adventurer named Halliburton traveled around the world and did pieces about, oh, the Sphinx or the Hoover Dam or the Panama Canal. There would be chapters. And I don't, you know, it told the story of creating it, but what stuck in my memory best was the fact that he swam the 51-mile length of the canal while doing his research. And he paid a toll. Now, based on tonnage, he paid 31 cents. After that, I covered the debate on the treaties in the Senate. I went down once during that fight, and then I also covered the formal handover in December of 1999. And I was casting about for a book idea, and I talked to some conservative friends, and I just thought this hadn't been focused on enough, and so that's how I got into it.
I was curious. It's my understanding that a few years after Carter signed the treaty in 1977, that Torrijos dies in a plane crash, and then shortly thereafter, Noriega takes power, and so there's this increasing instability in Panama. I was just wondering if there was any backlash towards Carter because of this, because Panama had become increasingly unstable and so concerned over how the Panama Canal was going to be handled?
Well, I think by the mid-'80s, almost everybody wanted to forget Jimmy Carter. And that's perhaps unfair, but I think that was the case. Now, there's a lot of suspicion that Noriega had something to do with that plane crash, but it's never been proved. The canal kept running. Nothing ever happened. It's running better today with more traffic. The government of Panama is planning to expand it, build a third wider set of locks so that big tankers and, for that matter, United States aircraft carriers can pass through it. They're using basically the plan developed by the United States. They started digging, doing a little digging in 1940, but then got distracted and never followed through. So the canal itself has kept functioning, and I think that diminished any concern. And indeed, most, though not quite all, of the people whom I talked to who had opposed the treaties said, well, you know, it's worked out better than we thought.
It would appear that a lot of the support against the treaty came because of the Vietnam War and the failure because of it. Do you think that if we had succeeded with the Vietnam War, that people wouldn't have been so emotional about losing the Panama Canal?
I think they'd have been less so. I'm not quite sure how we'd ever have won the Vietnam War. That's perhaps the bigger hole in that.
You said that after covering Washington and politics in Washington for four decades, you hadn't seen many examples like Howard Baker's. I didn't know that Howard Baker was so courageous until I heard your remarks on that particular issue, but I'm interested in the downside of that. Are there no profiles in courage in presidential candidates or in senatorial leaders today?
I'm hard-pressed to think of any that compare to that. Frankly, you might argue that McCain's support for immigration legislation carried that kind of a risk to him, although he abandoned that and said now he wouldn't vote for his own bill anymore. That's the closest example that occurs to me.
My question is your sense that the opposition to the canal was one more of political opportunism or a genuine concern for the national security? I mean, clearly the latter argument is no longer valid. If you look at the latest U.S. security publications and that sort of thing, it doesn't even appear anywhere on it. But my question is, what was the original reason that fight took place? Was it more one than the other?
Well, I think that's a complicated question. I think that the opponents, or at least almost all of them, sincerely believed that giving up the canal was bad for the United States, not necessarily because of the precise strategic value of the canal, which had diminished greatly over the years, even by then, but because, this was in Reagan's mind, really, the idea that after the United States had lost in Vietnam, giving up the canal would be a sign of weakness. And that's a sort of unprovable argument one way or another, I think. One of the few diehards, Howard Phillips, is sure that the Sandinista movement was propelled by our deciding to give up the canal. I differ. Howard also thinks Al-Qaeda is about to attack it. I figure if we still owned it, they would have. And it would have been a lot easier than flying three planes into the World Trade Center and the Pentagon. I think that the politics of it was also very obvious to most of them, and so I can't disentangle them. I think those are both heavy factors, and both of those arguments worked in large part because of the heritage of the way people had read about this in school and had grown up, you know, marveling at the United States' success where others had failed.
Mr. Clymer, you just gave me a segue for my question dealing with security.
security was a reasonable issue, I think, for people to consider as we looked at signing the treaty. Could you comment on what sorts of arrangements and negotiations actually did go on regarding security of the canal at that time, and what the status is of security of the canal now? Because certainly blowing up or destroying some aspect of the canal could have quite an impact on the world economy.
It could, certainly. What was negotiated at the time was the clear right of the United States to move in troops, ships, whatever it needed, if it thought the canal was menaced. The security argument for giving it up was that you took away the incentive for damaging it, which was in the hands of Panamanians who thought they were being treated like colonial subjects. Certainly, the ability for the United States to send troops or ships to secure the area still exists in the treaty, but I think the incentive for attacking it, I mean, Panama is nobody's villain. You know, I don't think Panama has any serious enemies. And attacking the main source of revenue and prestige for a small country would not particularly bring any popularity to any organization or nation that tried to do it.
I have felt during your presentation and the summaries I saw of your presentation before the talk that in your own mind the merits of the question were pretty obvious, and that therefore you had a full open field to emphasize the tremendous effect on American politics that had been caused by the dispute. And that case you make clearly and splendidly, showing how things happened with Reagan's career and the Republican majority that came to be in this Congress as a result of this agitation. But as you talked about it, I thought that the arguments that might have been made for the United States keeping a greater control than it came to have because of the treaty were not very sympathetically canvassed, as if your mind had pretty well made itself up on that score.
Well, I think the treaties were a good idea. I think the book clearly presents, and I didn't want to quote it at length, but clearly presents arguments that a lot of people made against the treaties, both in terms of the strategic implication and the argument best presented by Reagan about the importance of the United States not seeming weak at the time. So I think I haven't found any conservative readers who think their side was given a short shrift. There have been conservative reviewers who didn't like it. I think Human Events liked it. The National Review didn't, and we're waiting for somebody to break the tie. But David Keene, the chairman of the American Conservative Union, liked the book and threw a book party for it, and a lot of his contemporaries came around and said they'd been waiting for someone to make the case for them. So I think they think I've, you know, presented their arguments fairly.
I was living in South Louisiana at the time of the debate and remember hearing a great deal about Russell Long's role in the debate and the discussion. And one of the stories we heard was that Long changed his mind on the treaty after reading David McCullough's book on the Panama Canal. Wonder if you might comment on that and tell us whether or not his role was as important as it seemed at the time.
Long's role was important. I don't know all that went through his head. And McCullough's book, which had just come out, was central to arguments made on either side of the case. While McCullough himself urged the adoption of the treaty, opponents of it could find things in the book that made their arguments as well. The book is The Path Between the Seas. It's a great book. It's one of his best. I'm, I think, possibly his best. I'm not sure that I'm as fond of his biographies as I am of this book or the one about the Brooklyn Bridge called The Great Bridge. But it was a great book, and it did influence and inform a lot of senators. One thing I do know about Long was that he very early on told Carter that he didn't really like the idea, but if the president needed him, he was probably going to be available. Sam Nunn told me that Long said Nunn was a freshman senator and up for re-election. Said that Long told him, I'll vote the way you do, give you some cover, and that Herman Talmadge had said the same thing. Nunn said he thought both of them expected him to vote no. So I don't know.
I'm wondering if, in your opinion, the Panamanian people have been able to share the benefits of their ownership of the canal, or do the leaders keep all the money?
Well, I think there's no, first of all, there's no one has ever suggested that politics in Panama is as clean as, say, Wisconsin. But the benefits, the money that the canal has made has been largely plowed back into the canal and into this expansion project, so that I don't know that the Panamanians have profited particularly, except they're now running the canal. They have the jobs that they couldn't get when the Americans were running it. So, and that's a fairly substantial piece of their economy.
I'm interested in your own personal opinion. Now that we know the bottom line and we've experienced what has happened, was it a good idea or a bad idea?
It was a good idea, and it should have been handled better. But I think, in fact, I share Buckley's view that there would have been some sort of insurrection and attack on the canal, which would have made it almost impossible for the United States to turn it over, and we would have had a festering problem there probably still today. So I think it was a necessary way for a great power to behave as a grown-up. Carter was vastly overconfident about his ability to persuade the American people. It seemed logical to him, so he thought if he made some speeches and the polls would turn around. And there was a certain bumptiousness to his staff. Hamilton Jordan, his chief of staff, was a great guy in a lot of ways. Was also a great source for good quotes from the newspapers. He told Jim Wooten of the New York Times that what they were going to have to do was change the sort of mail that the senators were getting because, as he put it, these bastards don't have the guts to do anything but vote their mail. The Senate was displeased. And they figured out fairly early on that they weren't going to change public opinion overall. One of the things, before Carter, none of these previous presidents who had decided it was a good idea and had negotiated had made any effort whatever to educate the public on the subject. They always stopped. They never went far enough so they felt they ought to do it. And to bring it up without a treaty in hand seemed to be inviting trouble they didn't need. Ford could have negotiated the treaty, but put it on the back burner in August of 75 because of the impending Reagan challenge. They were close enough so they could have finished. The Carter people had various other tactics which helped them get some senators. They'd invite opinion leaders, newspaper editors, bankers, bar association officials, ministers to the White House for a briefing. And they managed to persuade them in groups like that, which provided some cover for senators, political cover. But they never understood the depth or the origins of the public's desire to keep the canal, and the polls never really changed.
I remember reading at the time of the turnover that there was some concern over possible growing influence of the Chinese on the canal because a firm from Hong Kong had won contracts to run ports on either end of the canal. Can you comment on that?
Sure. That company based in Hong Kong, was originally a British company based in Hong Kong, and runs ports all over the world, not in the United States. It came close to getting a contract in the 80s to run the port of Long Beach, but that was stopped for political reasons. A friend of mine put it this way. There are communists, there are Chinese communists and Chinese capitalists, and this is being run by the capitalists. They're running the port. They're not running canal operations, per se. And the port is running, the canal traffic and business is running better than it ever has before. But that was indeed a concern. It remains to people like Howard Phillips a concern today. He's when I mentioned his fear of Al-Qaeda, I slighted his fear of the Chinese communists. He's worried about them too.
I'd like to shift the focus, if I may, to contemporary political issues. You have been a very acute observer of the political scene on a national level for 40 years, and I think the 04 election was the first one where you were not on duty, so to speak. But I would like to ask if you were still working for the New York Times, and you had the opportunity to ask one or two questions of each of the four top of the ticket candidates, one and two position on the ticket candidates, what would you ask each one of them?
Now, George is taking advantage of me because I mentioned one question when we were talking beforehand. So I'll get that one out of the way first and hope the back of my mind can calculate answers for the other three. If I had some way of getting what I was sure would be an honest answer out of Sarah Palin, I would ask, did you think, whatever you told Charlie Gibson about how you said yes in an instant, did you ever think of turning down this nomination because of the embarrassment it would certainly bring your pregnant daughter? I'd like to know the answer to that. I mean, it's tempting in this occasion to bring up something about the canal with McCain because he was born in the canal zone, but the canal really isn't an issue anymore. I'd like to understand how McCain, whether there's more than simply campaign tactics to basically a senator who has been more of a darling of the press corps than anybody else I can think of, into running a campaign which is insistently hostile to the press. I mean, I've known John McCain. I didn't necessarily always agree with him, but it wasn't my job as a reporter to agree or disagree. But he was accessible. You always thought he was telling you what he thought, even if it was on the spur of the moment. And you don't get that sense of him these days. I guess I'd like to know from Barack Obama where, you know, I'd like to know more that would, I don't know how I'd ask the question, but I would like to know more about his experience, the way he relies on people for ideas. I'd like to be more convinced than I am of his ability to make some of his hopes come true and not just talk about change and hope, but to make them function in Washington. This is somebody who spent very little time in Washington, 4 years in the Senate, of which at least half has been spent running for president, and with no legislative record of any significance whatever there. Whereas McCain has a legislative record, some good stuff, some strange stuff, some plainly controversial. And senators don't necessarily make good presidents. But we're going to have one. I hold out no hope for Ralph Nader. And Joe Biden, I don't know what I'd ask Joe Biden. I know that it would probably hardly matter. I'd ask a little bit and then he'd talk for a long time about everything that came into his head.
The
The American public really has no opportunity at all, except in these mass events, to interact with the candidates, and the opportunities to ask questions are few and far between, and so we've come to rely on the press. And it seems that in each one of these elections, the largest audience comes in for the so-called presidential debates and the vice presidential debate. Looking at each of those who've been selected as moderators, could you give us a sense as to how you think each of the moderators who will be handling the debates this year will ask? And my reason for asking that is that certainly in 2000, Jim Lehrer was widely criticized for not asking aggressive questions or follow-up questions, and I see that he's back on the lineup this year, and as are others, and I'd sort of like to get your insight as to which will ask thoughtful, tough, probing questions.
Well, I suspect that Jim Lehrer will, if only because he read his reviews as well. I don't know, my favorites, and you know, I wouldn't have favored a Chris Matthews or the late Tim Russert, or the, you know, getting in the candidate's face. That only makes the candidate look good to the American public, even if the insistence is perfectly legitimate. I think Gwen Ifill will be tough on the vice presidential candidates. Gwen's an old friend. She worked at the Times with me for some years before going into television. And she's in an interesting position. She's going to be questioning the first Republican woman candidate for vice president, and one who doesn't, you know, who isn't comfortable taking policy questions, as anyone who watched Gibson's interview with her would think. And Bob Schieffer is another old friend. Well, so are Brokaw. Brokaw and Schieffer and I were all at the White House at the same time. They got a lot more attention. They got paid better. But they're all old friends, and they're all, you know, quite capable. But I suspect the most intriguing difference from the sports fans' view will be that I suspect Lehrer will be a lot tougher than he was the last time.
For those of us who miss Adam Clymer's comments in the New York Times, we have the opportunity to get his thinking in this wonderful book, Drawing the Line at the Big Ditch, and we greatly appreciate your being here with us today. Thank you.
Thank you.
For the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, I'm Dan Daniels.